I'll hold it. And thank you very much for having me. Thank you very much for those nice comments. I don't know, Rav Shama, it's like a hesped here. He talks so nice. But I'll put it on. And I will say it's especially good for me because I'm writing this as an article and being able to come into a community which is so influenced, as we'll see, by, I'll call him Rav Avadia, is important, especially because maybe in the questions and answers I'll be able to learn things from you that could help in my understanding. Let me begin by saying that outstanding rabbinic figures do not usually merit biographies in their lifetime. Indeed, most have to wait a good while after their passing until some enterprising doctoral student or someone in a Haredi world wants to put together an art school type biography, but it's almost always after their deaths. And yet, it's quite notable, therefore, that Rav Avadia was the subject in the last 2 years of two biographies and one scholarly study by Binyamin Lau on his works. So that shows you already that Rav Avadia is not like any other rabbi. What is it about Rav Avadia that makes him so significant? The answer is not simple, and it comes down to a combination of the religious and the political. Without Rav Avadia's entry into politics in 1983, the year he began his association with the newly founded Chas Party, he would have certainly had a much lower profile in the world. But while his influence in religious circles would have remained great, and as we'll see, perhaps even greater, because his image has been tarnished by this foray into politics, he would not have had the wider significance that he currently has, making him undoubtedly the only rabbi recognized by every Israeli. You show them the picture, everyone knows who Rav Avadia is. Now, two of these books that recently came out are complete biographies by religious people, by the way, from people, Rabbani, one's a Rav, they're both co-authored. And they show the complexity of the man, how he rose from his humble beginnings to become not only the world's most important rabbi, but also one of the leading power brokers in Israeli politics. Incidentally, I'll just point out that since we live in an era, you know, the chumras every year, more and more, which rabbis, I know of two rabbis who even declared that it's forbidden to go, let's say, to a place like Starbucks and get a cup of coffee unless the Starbucks has hashgacha on it. It's refreshing to read the stories about how when Rav Avadia was in Cairo, he and his students used to go to the local coffee houses for coffee, and it's perhaps there that Rav Avadia picked up his great love of Arabic music that is one of his characteristics. Now, a feeling that comes across in both biographies is that Rav Avadia presents a paradox for anyone writing about him or wanting to study about him. On the one hand, he's a man whose sheer knowledge is unmatched. None of the other great rabbinic figures in our era even come close to him in terms of knowledge. No question about it. And I believe it's impossible to take seriously a so-called chief rabbinate of Israel in which Rav Avadia does not hold that position. And as mentioned already, he's a man who comes from very humble beginnings, entirely lacking any of the yichus, which is so important in the rabbinic world. Now, throughout his career, he has shown courage and compassion, great courage, being it during his time in Egypt, when he battled against the communal leaders that didn't care about Shabbos or Kashrus, the local old Jewish old age home, served treif, and he battled against them. He spent many sleepless nights after the Yom Kippur War, painstakingly going over, I think it was 700 files of soldiers whose wives were agunas, and he didn't rest until every one of these women was declared free to marry. It's no surprise that he's earned the admiration of hundreds of thousands, observant and non-observant alike, and those who know Rav Avadia personally, and I'm sure there's some in this room, know him to be a loyal and honorable man, prepared to suffer the slings and arrows of others in the name of truth as he sees it. Yet the paradox is that the man who spends most of his day devoted to the most advanced level of Torah study has also consistently shown a side more reflective of the low culture of his youth that he came from. And there is, to be sure, a very positive side to this. No other scholar in the Sephardic world has been able to form an attachment to the masses like Rav Avadia. As anyone who has attended his Saturday night lectures, as I had the privilege to do when I was in Israel from 84 to 85, can attest, and by the way, you can listen to these lectures on maran1.com. They have them every week. You can watch them. His mix of Torah, stories, humor has a great appeal to the man of the street. He uses the slang of the street. He comes from, as I say, doesn't come from the upper crust. He comes from the lower crust. And this is a quality Rav Avadia has had since his young days as a student, when already at 14, 15, 16 years old, he was giving shiurim and attracting everyone because he could relate to the average person. In addition to his great knowledge, which is from early on, he has this great gift of reaching the less educated. Yet together with this, Rav Avadya has been known for what, in the minds at least of most of people, seem to be outrageous statements, as well as cursing out this or that politician and promising heavenly reward to people who vote for his party. And not surprisingly, the secular newspapers go to every one of his shiurim looking for that next juicy quote. And in this book, these two books that have come out, they have a whole chapter on this explaining, and again, these are people from the inside, these are not out secularists, what is about the man that he almost can always be counted on to come up with something. And they didn't, these books appeared before the Katrina incident. You all remember why it was, and you can, if you go to the website, you don't have to look for it. This is one of the things that are that you can click on immediately because they want people to click on it. Why was there a hurricane? It was a punishment for Bush. Happens to be the most pro-Israel president we ever had for supporting the leaving of Gaza. And why was it in New Orleans? Because the blacks live there and they don't study Torah. And you remember the outcry over this. And there are plenty of similar examples that show we are not dealing with someone who occasionally misspeaks. But it's almost like you say two aspects of one personality or two personalities. And this isn't surprising to those who follow the career. And it's up to the minions of the followers to then try to go to the newspapers the next day and explain. So what to make then of one who soars the heights of Torah scholarship? And yet, in the, you can be counted on, the ADL can be counted on to have something to comment on about this. The same man who brought Shas into the labor merits government. And immediately the Haredim went after him like you wouldn't believe. Also can call Yossi Sarid, who's in the same coalition, Haman, and God will uproot this Amalek. The same man who has been strongly, except until recently, with some change of position, although in fact, not in theory, in support of giving back land for peace, can also call the Arabs snakes. So you have a paradox here, which we'll talk about. A complicated figure. And these two biographies, if you read Hebrew, I really recommend. One in particular is a real page-turner. These are not Haredi biographies. And they had the cooperation of Rav Avadya. He supplied them with his personal... They don't say this, but both of them have Rav Avadya's personal diaries. And when I spoke to one of the authors, I said, well, how'd you get the personal diaries? He must have given it to you. He says, I'm not going to say he gave it to me, but we have the personal diaries. So they make for fascinating reading. And they include stuff that will never be found in a Haredi biography. They detail with things I just spoke about. They detail the difficult relationship with one of his sons, Rabbi Yaakov, a great Talmud Chacham, maybe the greatest of his sons. But Rabbi Yaakov left his orbit and went into the more of the Chardal, the Dati Lumi, and he is one of the leading Rabbanim for the National Religious Party, very much on the right politically. Both volumes, as I said, quote from the unpublished diaries, which have many negative comments in them, and Rav Avadya permitted them to quote this, in particular about his predecessor, Rav Nissim, who I can't get into the details now, but there was a very difficult relationship. Rav Avadya, basically Rav Nissim was kicked out so Rav Avadya could come in. As well as negative comments about Rav Kaduri early on. Rav Avadya had no patience for these Kabbalist miracle workers, although later on Rav Kaduri became an important part of the Shas machine with the amulets. But Rav Avadya presumably let these diaries out to let people know that even though we brought him in to get votes, that he's never been impressed, Rav Avadya, with miracle workers. For Rav Avadya, Torah study is the important thing, not miracle working. Now, in seeking to understand him, I'm going to talk a little bit about the politics and then focus on why he's so important halakhically. In seeking to understand him, there's two ways to view him. One is to view him in his totality, as these biographies do, and the other is to separate the halakhic achievement from the political persona. And I believe that Rav Avadya's scholarship should stand on its own, both in the area of how, in research, you can stand on its own, just like you can write an article on the Nota Behuda's halakhic scholarship without getting into all the personal things, as well as in how we relate to him. And why do I say that? Because I think that his curses of this prime minister or that will thankfully be forgotten by future generations. But his Torah study will go on forever. And we could say politics, lachlub, Torah, lachlub. You know, the two are separate. And I think this is also very important for those who are on the right politically. Because if you're right on the right politically, you have a real problem here. Because then you're going to, what do you do about Rav Avadya? He opposes your position. And I think it's very dangerous for Torah Jews to start, as they often do, posseling, is that a Sephardic word, to make pasul Torah figures because we don't like their hashkafa. You have to say, yes, you might not like his hashkafa in politics, but his Torah you know, is not affected by that. I mean, some of you might disagree. We only have time for questions and answers, and say the two have to be joined together. I don't think so. Now, since Rav Avadia has often taken positions not in accord with the leaders of the Ashkenazi Haredim, it's not surprising that he has often been a focus of their anger. And much of this has to do with his political positions, as well as Shas's emergence as the leading fervently Orthodox, let's say, use that term, which marginalized the once important Haredi parties. The Haredi parties used to be able to make governments and bring them down. Once Shas came on the scene, these parties were marginalized, and they remain marginalized. When he was affiliated with the Ashkenazi Haredim, before he broke off on his own, in Yatei Neman and all these other newspapers, he would be referred to with all the titles that mean so much in the Haredi world. Maran, all these titles. When he parted with them, he became persona non grata, and all of a sudden it was permissible to attack him in all sorts of ways. Precisely doing exactly what I said people should not do, because they don't agree with his politics, all of a sudden now he can be attacked. It's not only Rav Avadia's political outlook that brought down the wrath of the Haredim. For example, after the Yom Kippur War, he worked tirelessly to free all the Agunot. And this was a very important element, forming his reputation as a leading halachas. Any posek who deals with the issue of Aguna has to study his, I think it's like some 40-page long tshuva with thousands of sources dealing with how he freed these Agunot. But in a recent Haredi work that discusses this episode, Rav Avadia is referred to as Ovadia, without even putting the resh before his name. He is also derided as one, quote, will rely, and this is in the name of one of the leading Ashkenazi Haredi Gedolim from Bnei Brak, quote, one who will rely on a responsum, even if it is from a book which is not accepted, for such as from some author in Egypt, or something similar. I would merely add that for the Ashkenazi Haredim, an author from Egypt, in the last few hundred years, maybe after the Rambam, or after the Radbaz, I don't think any author from Egypt after the Radbaz would ever count as, quote, accepted, as their perspective is entirely Ashkenazic-centered. Standard works in the Sephardic halachic tradition, such as Erech HaShulchan, Petach HaDevir, Yafel Alev, the numerous writings of Rav Chaim Palachi, these are simply not, and many less important Sephardic writings, these are not part of the Ashkenazi canon. And Haredi posts simply pay them no regard. Now, although the dispute over Agunot was one of many halachic disagreements between Rav Avadia and the Haredi leaders, the fact remains that had he not taken a different political stand from them, they wouldn't have attacked him for these things. He still would have been part of their group. Indeed, in the early years of the Shas party, when it was basically a party of Rav Shach, the dominant influence was Rav Shach, and Rav Avadia was his protege. And the titles that mean so much, as I said, were affixed to his name. When I read Haredi attacks today on Rav Avadia, I must confess that they remind me of a gnat taking on an elephant. Rav Avadia simply marches on, oblivious, it appears, to the carping. He is aware, certainly, that if he falls in line with the Das Torah of Bnei Brak, he will once again be welcomed in the Haredi world as one of the Gedolei Hador. But there's no reason for him to pay this any regard. The harshness of the attacks on both him and the Shas party, I believe, show how politically powerless the Ashkenazi have become, the Haredi Ashkenazi in the state of Israel. It's Rav Avadia who has all the power and influence. And the screaming about him doing this and that and going against the Gedolim, I believe, are the desperate cries of people who no longer control, as they would say, the firm world, like they used to. Ever since Shas broke away, it has been the dominant force in religious politics in Israel. It has held the purse strings and the agenda, and with this obviously have come the inevitable financial corruption that a number of Shas figures have been involved with. In short, Rav Avadia has become the religious power broker of the state of Israel. And this is an enormous success story when you consider that in 1992, Rav Shach famously declared that Sephardim were not capable of leading, not yet capable of leading. Now this comment, coming on top of decades of discrimination against Sephardim in the Ashkenazic school system and society, which still exists, girls, they can't get into the Ashkenazi schools, was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of Shach breaking off on its own. After that comment was made, led to a strong feeling of ethnic identification with Shas by Sephardim of all levels of religious commitment. Rav Shach's picture was ripped up in development towns as people declared they would never again vote for the Ashkenazim, the Franks. Shas plastered Rav Avadia's patronizing comments on walls throughout Israel, and Shas vans drove through the development towns playing over the tape, stoking the flames of anti-Ashkenazic sentiment to Shas's advantage. Now look, the contempt which with the Haredim view, the Sephardim is well known, and there's no need to go into it here. It's paralleled by a lot of discrimination in the non-Orthodox Ashkenazi community. So suffice it to say that there has not yet been a Brown versus Board of Education in the state of Israel, and the Haredi school systems continue to discriminate against Sephardim and have no problem with it. Yet I would also like to defend Rav Shach here, if I can, that his comment was not as bad as it appeared, and it certainly was not racist as it was accused, because what he meant was that Ashkenazi, through their historical experiences, know how to deal with the anti-Torah forces. They've lived with them for over 100 years. It's with reference to this that Rav Shach said that the Sephardim haven't had the opportunity to deal with these people. They don't know what they're like. And some would say that Rav Shach actually showed some prophetic insight, because just a few weeks after that comment, Shas decided to join a coalition with Meretz, in which Shlomo Aloni was the Minister of Education. Rav Avadya famously declared, what's the difference if it's Meretz or Sharon? They're all the Chalei Shabbos. And Rav Shach's point was that there's a difference between a typical non-religious and a Meretz type. So I will defend Rav Shach. And some of you might even say that in retrospect, he was quasi-prophetic in this, as well as in a number of other... I have to confess, at Chatai, some of you, if you look up on the internet, you'll find my name giving this whole thing that how wrong Rav Shach is about his statements about Lubavitch. This is about 15 years ago. You can't get rid of these things. You know, once you put something on the internet, unfortunately, it's there forever. And it turns out he was pretty right about a lot of that. Now, in truth, the Shas Ashkenazi break was inevitable. Sephardic society was ripe for an ethnic party that would encompass the wider community, which, while not totally observant, still had a strong attachment to tradition. Now, as for those Sephardim who had been educated in the Haredi institutions and had begun to adopt a certain Sephardic Haredi culture, how long were they supposed to take orders from the Ashkenazic Haredi sages who conducted their deliberations in Yiddish and had no place at the table for Sephardic Gedolim? Yeah, they put someone low down on the Aguda list of Sephardi, but there weren't any Sephardi involved in making decisions for Aguda. They took them for granted, as parties always do if they don't have to reach out. And here is Rav Avadya's real significance. It's Rav Avadya who single-handedly restored the pride to Sephardic Jewry. The slogan of Shas, L'achzir atara l'yoshna, to return the crown to its former glory, says it all. Rav Avadya ushered in a new era where Sephardim were no longer to be regarded or regard themselves as second-class citizens, either in society at large or in the Torah world. And this was a great social achievement and is the reason why numerous Sephardim who are not observant voted for Shas. As is well known, you know it better than me, Sephardic society has a range of levels of observance. But even those who are not totally observant have a great respect for tradition. And Shas was able to tap into these feelings with great success through the many schools he established and the kollels and yeshivas. I mean, I was saying, it's a great story. I was in the airport once in Israel, and someone was carrying through a Torah to take back to America, I guess. And all these Sephardim, and you're sitting down, they covered up their heads, put something on their head, they went to kiss the Torah. The Ashkenazim, some of these Ashkenazim have been in Israel 3 generations. They probably don't even know what Torah is, what it looks like. So, I mean, we all know, you go into the falafel stand in Israel, you have the picture of a Avadya on the wall. These people are not Shomer Shabbos, but it's a different type of religiosity. So from this perspective, there's nothing surprising about the wide-ranging level of support for Shas. Yet what makes Rav Avadya's political achievement even more significant is that until the Gaza withdrawal, he was identified with the dovish political positions. And in addition to this, Rav Avadya had a very close relationship to Shimon Peres. It's never been a secret that Rav Avadya is firmly convinced, although practically it might not be a good idea, but halachically, if you can get real peace, you give up the land. And yet the view of the typical Sephardic voter is very much to the right. These people came from the Arab lands. Yet many of them have been... Although I did see in the Jewish Week the last couple of weeks, it is not unanimous among the Syrians. Yeah. But certainly they are firmly on the right, and they're the ones who brought the Likud to power. Yet, most of them were willing to overlook these significant differences. After all, that's why you vote for a political party. What's the most important issue in Israel? It's the security issue, and yet so many Sephardim were willing to overlook this, but because of the great respect they had for Rav Avadya, they voted for him anyway. And now, this says a lot, I think, also to the strength of Rav Avadya's character, in that He stuck to his dovish positions, even though he knew that he would have been able to pick up even more Knesset seats. He had 17, I think, was the highest number. He would have been able to pick up even more had he adopted a more right-wing position. All those Sephardim that vote for Likud. And yet he stuck to his position anyway. In recent years, he's had more hawkish position because it seems that there is no one to make peace with. But the idea that he can make peace, if there's a real partner, you can give a plan. He's firmly convinced of this. He published a Torah article explaining why Pikuach Nefesh, saving life, goes before land. Now, one should not only think that it's only Shas, which for political reasons spoke about the Ashkenazic-Sephardi divide. Rav Avadia himself has made a number of statements critical of Ashkenazi society. And these are not only intended for the ears of the masses, as some reflect more serious concerns. For example, in the introductions to volume 1 and 3 of his magnum opus, his response to Yabia Omer, he is strongly critical of the yeshiva world, the Ashkenazi yeshiva world's approach to Torah study, since it's focused on theoretical analysis rather than practical halakha. And it also discourages students from studying Achronim, recent authors. Rav Avadia says, well, using that logic, no one's going to study your writings because you're also an Achron. One of Rav Avadia's first acts when he became chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in 1969 was to permit Sfaradim to marry from the 17th of Tammuz to the 1st of Av. Contrary to the Ashkenazic practice, which forbids weddings during that period, and all of Tel Aviv had been following that practice, Rav Avadia explained that the previous Sephardic rabbis in Tel Aviv had been too much in awe, or they haven't been, didn't feel comfortable in challenging the Ashkenazim, but he obviously felt comfortable and was able to say, we're Sephardim, we don't have to follow that practice. Along similar lines, when the State of Israel was established, the first chief rabbi, the great chief rabbi, Rav Uziel, signed a document, a takana, with Rav Herzog, banning Yibum. There's an old dispute. Ashkenazim believe that if you need a levirate marriage, someone dies and leaves a wife with no children, the brother does chalitza. But Sephardim, the tradition always was, I don't know if it still is, Yibum. Is it still the tradition?
It's mixed.
The Ashkenazim got the Sephardim to agree that it doesn't really work anymore because people don't have the right kavanot, the right reasons, so they banned it. Rav Avadia says, that's giving in on our tradition. And he permitted Yibum when he became chief rabbi. So he was not cowed. He had strong sense of his own significance. Although Rav Avadia's tshuvot, his responsa, always show respect for the Ashkenazic scholars, even when rejecting his opinion, this has not always been the case when speaking to his followers. A storm arose, just to give one example of the numerous, when Rav Avadia downplayed the significance of the Chazon Ish. Now, who's the Chazon Ish? The Chazon Ish is the most important Haredi figure in the 20th century. He is the one that set up the approach, how Haredim relate to the State of Israel, that is, don't reject it totally, not anti-Zionist, but don't support it, not non-Zionist, basically wanting nothing to do with it unless we have to deal with it. And he's without question the most important Haredi figure of the 20th century. Rav Avadia has none of the feeling of awe, though, for him, because he's just another prominent Ashkenazi posek. And in this case, he went so far as to declare that the Chazon Ish was not to be regarded as a halachic decisor, a mora hora'ah, because he was a private citizen without communal responsibilities. A real mora hora'ah is one who has communal responsibilities, who when he gives a ruling has to know how it's going to affect everyone, not just to a community of scholars in B'nai Brak. I mean, the chumras, the Chazon Ish was able to give chumras because people coming to him were all, you know, yeshiva bachrim and all that, but that's not for Rav Avadia. And he says, quote, he loved to be stringent, adding chumrot on top of chumrot. Now this is about the Chazon Ish. For those who only know the Rav Avadia of today, who towers above Shas with great political clout, it will be surprising if you read, let's say, the biographies, to hear how the party itself was brought into power, was created really with the blessing of Rav Shach. And in the early years, Rav Avadia was really a pawn of the Ashkenazi Haredim, doing what they wanted. The story of how Rav Avadia finally summoned the courage, and both books have large chapters on this, how he finally summoned the courage and decided, I have to go out on my own. We can no longer take orders from them. And he even lost some people on his Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah that he has, Moetzet Chachmei HaTorah it's called, who were followers of the Ashkenazim. And it really speaks to his great courage. And it's inspiring. And in that, it speaks not just to his motivation, but the confidence he had that the people would follow him. The rabbis all wouldn't, and that's true, but the people would follow him, and they did follow him. The Haredi response was severe, as Rav Avadia knew it would be. But as so often in his career, he made a shrewd move, and it catapulted immediately in the first election. He became more important than all the Haredi parties, Ashkenazi ones. And the notion that a Haredi political party with incredible drawing power should take orders from Ashkenazim, whose political clout was insignificant. And when I say Ashkenazim, Sephardim, they're very much split in the Haredi circles. If you go into it, I think this is the great achievement of the religious Zionist circles, the Dati, Lomi, the Dati, is that there's no difference. Sephardim, Ashkenazim, they all marry each other. One kahila. You go into a yeshiva, like the Ezra yeshivas or America Israel, there's no Sephardim, Ashkenazim anymore. But in the Haredi world, they still have these splits, so it is a real thing. But the idea that these Sephardi Haredim and the ethnic Sephardim, ethnic attached Sephardim would take orders from the Ashkenazim is an idea that really could have only come from people with a very paternalistic view towards the Sephardim. And I confess, honestly, to seeing great satisfaction in seeing the Haredi parties dwarfed in representation by the very people they attempted to convince that you were not worthy, you were not qualified to decide your own destiny. I mean, I acknowledge that. Now, in terms of his long-term significance, there is no question that Rav Avadia is the most important Sephardic figure since Rav Yosef Karo Maran, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. It can be truthfully stated that from Yosef Karo to Yosef, to Avadia Yosef, none has arisen like Yosef. I will tell you that this statement used to be made, I'm not the first one to make it. They made the same statement about the Chida, Rav Yosef Chaim David Azurai, because he was the most important Sephardic rabbi after Rav Yosef Karo, and the only one, other than Maran, Shulchan Aruch, who they called Maran Achida. But Rav Avad Yosef is more important than Achida, as we'll see. Much, much more important. So you can really skip the Maran Achida and go right to Maran Avad Yosef. Unlike other Gedolim, who were his contemporaries and were truly giants of their time, men such as Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, mamish giants who had influence over all of Kol Yisrael, Rav Avadia is not simply a giant for his generation. He has accomplished the very rare feat, you only see this a few times in our history, of permanently altering the course of Torah history in both a halachic and a religious and a sociological sense, as I'll explain. It is typical that the greatest of poskim only have real influence in their lifetimes. And soon after their deaths, the influence begins to wane. And that's to be expected. I could give you names of poskim who towered over their communities and no one would have ever even heard of them today because they lived 100 years ago. Take Rav Moshe Feinstein, who, as I said, towered over Kol Yisrael. There is no question that his halachic influence today is nowhere near what it was during his lifetime when he dominated Torah Jewry. First, take just his position on the Erev in Brooklyn. During his lifetime, no one believed in the Ashkenazic world of putting up an Erev. Because he said no, but now, you see the arguments in Machlokot going on. Plenty of Ashkenazim have no problem with this Eruv. Yet the halachic enterprise that Rav Avadia has created has permanently altered the halachic traditions of Sephardic Jewry. Rav Avadia's tendency, first of all, is to be lenient. And in the months leading up to his election as chief rabbi, he actually touted this. He said that the Sephardic rabbinate, he will be like the Sephardic rabbinate, which is like Beit Hillel, searching for the leniency not to make people's lives difficult. He contrasted this with the Ashkenazim, who he said were like Beit Shammai. While there are exceptions to this lenient tendency, most notably his consistent position for 40 years now that women cannot wear shadels. It's forbidden. They can only wear tichels. The shadels are forbidden. For the most part, he's certainly in the other direction. Examination of his many responses show that in almost every single case he's confronted with a mamzer and aguna, he always finds a way to free the woman or free the child. Today there is no doubt that the address for all complicated questions of personal status, aguna to mamzer, all that, is Rav Avadia. In other issues as well we see leniency. Take Jonathan, for example. The American Orthodox community has generally followed the rulings of Rav Moshe Feinstein or Aaron Cutler that gelatin is not permissible. I will tell you, before then, if you go to the 40s and 50s, the 30s, all the American Orthodox rabbanim did eat gelatin, following Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski's opinion. But since then, none of the major hashkach organizations in America will give the permission to gelatin. If anything is able to change matters in the United States, it's Rav Avadia's tshuva that all gelatin, whether from the bones or pig skin, is kosher. Similarly, his tshuva, that one dishwasher is sufficient, perfect, eminently reasonable on pure halakha grounds, is not the consensus in America, at least among Ashkenazim. But, like all consensuses, this too is liable to change. Another great leniency, which would be unthinkable in this country, is his ruling that a restaurant that serves both milk and meat, either together, cold, or one after another, must be given hashkacha if asked for it. I mean, you can imagine going to the Vada Fathers and say, give me Hashgacha, we're serving milk and meat, same restaurant. It would be unimaginable. He terms this a Chovah Kedusha, a holy obligation. Because by giving the Hashgacha, first of all, you're ensuring that the meat is kosher, and you're preventing worse things. At least you're ensuring that they're not mixing at the same time. You know, it's one after the other, or you're not cooking it together, at least. I mean, incredible. I have noticed that even when it comes to using hot water on Shabbat, which most poskim, I believe that you can't use hot water because it causes the furnace to go on. In an early tshuva, he agreed, but in a more recent volume, he explains why it should be permitted, and he concludes that it's ra'oi l'achmir. It's best not to use hot water, but anyone who knows halakha literature knows when it says ra'oi l'achmir, that means if you feel you need it, if you're an istanist, that is, it's difficult, if you're old, you need to heat up a pot, whatever it is, that certainly he's giving the door open for those rabbis who want to. You know, it's a psik reisha de lo nichla. He explains all the reasons, we can't get into it now, why it should be permissible. Now, operating in an environment, and he hasn't used the word forbidden, that's important. Operating in an environment in which there's no conservative Judaism, you all know that in the Reform, in the Sephardic world, you don't have reforming, especially reform is irrelevant, but you don't have conservative and others. You just have people who are more observant and less observant. There's no threat to the halachic process. Certainly the conservative movement used to be a threat, I don't think anymore, but it used to be because people, they were giving a tearing too. Rav Avadya doesn't have to worry about, is this going to lead to people saying, well, you're like the conservatives, or lead to a breakdown of tradition. He's able to approach matters just looking at the halacha. Take his tshuva on the bat mitzvah. All the Ashkenazi rabbanim who dealt with the bat mitzvah service, ceremony for girls, said, well, you know, the conservatives started it, you know, we're going to be giving approval to what the conservatives did. Mordechai Kaplan is the first. For him, it's just look at the halacha. You know, it's a suda, you know, what's, he doesn't have these issues. Rav Avadya's vision is clear. A Torah society in which the Sephardic authorities lead. The halachot of this society, talk about the land of Israel, are to be decided in accordance with the Shulchan Aruch. In some of his writings, one gets the impression that even Ashkenazim who live in Israel have to follow the Shulchan Aruch, because you go to Israel and that's the Mara Da'atra, and you have to follow him. But at other times, you must conclude the opposite. And he's only speaking to Sfaradim. For example, otherwise, what sense would it make for him to have a tshuva about kitniyot for Ashkenazim, in which he never says that in the land of Israel, Ashkenazim don't need to keep kitniyot? I believe if you go ask him as an Ashkenazi, he will tell you you don't have to, I think. But certainly he's not saying this publicly. Yet even with respect to Sfaradim, this position that all Sfaradim must follow the Shulchan Aruch, which he's held since his youth, has been very controversial. It came to the fore when, as a young man, he lectured in his own Iraqi community. And during these shiurim, he dissented numerous times from the Ben Ish Chai, who was the authority for the Iraqi Jews, unquestioned authority. In recalling those days, and the controversy that arose, Rav Avadya mentions that he received the approval of his teacher, of Ezra Atiyah, of the Parat Yosef Yeshiva. But his acts were very controversial and among his own rabbis. And the opposition reached its peak in the early 1950s when the Iraqi community came close to putting him in cherem, and his books were burnt, his Chazon Avadya. People had disrupted his shiurim. For them, it was unforgivable that this young person, not even 20 years old, would be coming about telling people not to follow the Ben Ish Chai, which they had followed for all these years and was regarded as the unquestioned authority. But according to Rav Avadya, when you're in the land of Israel, you must follow the Shulchan Aruch. Even if Rav Yosef Chaim says something differently, and Rav Yosef Chaim on a number of occasions does, based on Kabbalistic reasons, says we don't follow what the Shulchan Aruch says. As it was, Rav Avadya's position is hardly traditional, I think. As far as I know, he is the first posek in history to make such a far-reaching claim as to the significance and binding nature of the Shulchan Aruch in its entirety. Previous poskim had recognized that various communities had long-standing practices that diverged from the Shulchan Aruch, and that since these practices had the approval of great rabbinic authorities, they could not be abolished. And even the Shulchan Aruch, in his own introduction, says this. And yet Rav Avadya is less tolerant than this, and for a reason I can't comprehend, insists on uniformity with the Shulchan Aruch's rulings that the Shulchan Aruch itself did not insist upon. And let me give you an example which illustrates the problems his position has created. There's an old question. Can women make a bracha on time-bound positive commandments? Mitzvot Aseh Shazman Grama. Take a lulav. Can a woman make a bracha on the lulav? Classic Ashkenazic position, going back to the medieval times, yes. Classic Sephardic position, recorded in the Shulchan Aruch, no, they cannot. Yet, numerous Sephardic communities, women did make the bracha. The Chida, the other Maran, the other Yosef, ruled that they could make this bracha. Rav Avadya will have none of this. For decades now, he has been insisting that all Sfardim must adopt the Shulchan Aruch's ruling, which means that Sfardim are called to abandon a practice hundreds of years old, which even predates the Shulchan Aruch, and is found in communities all over the Sephardic world. One of Rav Avadya's great opponents in Israel, a man by the name of Rav Yaakov Chaim Sofer, the great-grandson of the Kaf HaChaim, has a long essay in which he goes to every community. It's about 20 different Sephardic communities in which the practice, he's a great baki, the practice was to make the bracha. So, I mean, but this has created controversy. And yet, Rav Avadya's authority has been able basically to triumph, as we'll see. Some rabbinic figures have attempted to uphold their community's practice, but faced with the overwhelming authority and charisma of Rav Avadya Yosef, this has become very difficult. In addition to this, Rav Avadya's son, Rav Yitzchak, has published a very popular, I'm sure many of you know it, Yalkut Yosef, some 30 volumes, which is a new code of Jewish law. It's a new code based on Rav Avadya Yosef's position, which is now the code for Sfardim in the land of Israel, and that has enabled Rav Avadya's position to become popular. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, the many Sidurim published by Rav Avadya's followers, pretty much all the Sidurim you get in Israel, are published by Rav Avadya's followers, and they tell you, don't make this bracha. So this has succeeded in pretty much guiding the masses and uprooting this practice. We can term this Team Rav Avadya. They have been very successful in uprooting the variety of local practices that developed in the Sephardic diaspora and came to Israel, and creating a unified Sephardic land of Israel practice. While most Sephardim have fallen into line, this is not the case for all. I will tell you that the Moroccans, the one figure who had the credentials, the stature to stand up to Rav Avadya, is Rav Shalom Messas, chief rabbi of Casablanca, later became chief rabbi of Morocco, of Jerusalem. He refused to acknowledge that just because Moroccans were now in the land of Israel, they had to abandon their traditions of 1,000 years in favor of the Shulchan Aruch. Following his lead, in the last 10 years, there's been about 8 or 9 books by Moroccan rabbis justifying Rav Messas' position and justifying their community's practices, all the while showing great respect for Rav Avadya, whom they regard as the Gadol Hador. So it's very interesting, these Moroccan rabbis showing great respect for the man they believe is the Gadol Hador, still explaining why, b'mechilat kavodo, with great, with his pardon, great deference, we disagree, Rav Avadya. Another interesting example, where Rav Avadya has taken on a widespread Sephardic practice, concerns the lighting of Shabbat candles on Friday nights. According to the common and most likely understanding of Shulchan Aruch, one is supposed to make the bracha and then light the candles. And Rav Avadya has ruled this is how women, Sephardic women, must conduct themselves. However, in many Sephardic communities, there was a long-standing practice, just like the Ashkenazim do, light and then make the bracha. In fact, this practice was also supported by the Chidah, whose dominant position among the Sephardim, as I said, was he was given the title Maran. By insisting that women make the bracha and then light, he also went against the practice of his own Iraqi community. Before Rav Avadya's rise to prominence, the Ben Ish Chai, as I said, was king. And he held that women should light the candles and then make the bracha. Yet Rav Avadya was willing to take on this practice. By now, his victory is almost complete in this area. He has been able to accomplish almost the impossible. Influence thousands of women to change a well-entrenched practice. Just think of what Shabbos candlelighting is. It's what a mother gives her daughter. A daughter grows up with this. It's enraptured with a ritual and religiosity. You know how to do it. You saw your mother, your grandmother. And here a rabbi comes and says, don't do it the way your mother, your grandmother, everyone else did it. And he was successful. What other rabbi could ever do something like that? Rav Avadya was able to. Now his ideological adversary, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who represents the old guard of the Iraqi community, continues to assert the old practice of the Ben Ish Chai. Light and then make the bracha. And he has a sidur too, called Kol Eliyahu. But he cannot compete with either the popularity or the scholarship of Rav Avadya. But make no mistake about it. By declaring a practice no less than the bracha levatala, a forbidden, a practice which has such deep roots in the Sephardic community, it is Rav Avadya who's radical and revolutionary. A fact which very few realize. Finally, I must say a word about the most incredible feature of Rav Avadya's writings, and that's his incredible bikiyut. Knowledge. Encyclopedic knowledge, the like which has never been seen in the Jewish history. There have been great bikiyim prior to Rav Avadya, Rav Yosef Zacharya Stern, Rav Chaim Palachi. Incredible Bikim. Yet these men lived over 100 years ago. And they can't compare to Rav Avadya, if only because in their intervening 100 years, the amount of responsa literature has more than doubled. That is, from 1890 to 1990, let's say, or today, more works have been published than in all of history before 1890. And Rav Avadya has mastered every one of these significant works. The knowledge in his mind is simply beyond belief and is impossible to describe in words. It's an unequaled memory which has no use for the various CD-ROMs that have made Bikiyut less valuable in today's day and age. And I was recently asked by Rabbi Natav from Canada if I have ever encountered such a mind in academia. And I have to say no, I have not. But it's this question that got me thinking. How would someone like Rav Avadya be viewed in the academic world? And this can also help, I think, explain why the Lithuanian yeshiva world has been less than overwhelmed by him. You know, they don't seem to be following him. They're not overwhelmed, even though he clearly has more knowledge in his fingertips than their Rosh Yeshiva ever have or will have. Why not? Well, let me explain. If you take one of the great Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, you have someone with a great mind who is able to produce stunning Talmudic insights. Take a Rav Aaron Cutler, for example. Had he not remained in the yeshiva world, you know, he had a sister who was a communist who, to the end of her life, thought he made a big mistake when he became a Malamed. She said, you know, he could have been a scientist. Had he not remained in the yeshiva world, Rav Aaron Cutler could have been a brilliant mathematician or a scientist, Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Had he not devoted himself to Torah, he could have excelled in philosophy, mathematics, any field he set his mind to. And that is the motto, basically, of the Lithuanian Talmudic genius. Yet, when it has to be said, when you look at Rav Avadya, and this is what the yeshiva world would say, and I believe it's correct, you don't find analytical brilliance. That's not what you find. I'm not going to say Sfaradi don't have it. Chas v'shalom. Rav Uziel, for example, is a classic example. Some might say Rav Uziel is the last Sfaradic rabbi. I heard someone say that for reasons we can talk. But he had real analytic brilliance. Yeah, many. Rav Avadya does not have analytic brilliance. He has a photographic memory. By the standards of the academic world and the Lithuanian yeshiva world, that doesn't count for much. In the academic world, you're judged by the significance of your publications. And in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, by the profundity of your shiurim. In the academic world, and Rav Avadya doesn't have shiurim. That's not how he works. In the academic world, if your prime distinguishing characteristic is your photographic memory, even if it's photographic memory like the likes once in every 500 years, that won't necessarily even guarantee you an interview. And in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, you're not going to be able to teach a shiur. Because that's not what they're looking for. And this is the challenge that Rav Avadya presents to both the academic and the Lithuanian yeshiva world. Where, for good or bad, his type of knowledge is not a type of knowledge that is generally valued. It's the Cyprus is quoted as saying, yes, we can look into his books. He gives us lots of good sources. So it's helpful, but it's not valued. When one looks at the truly groundbreaking thinkers, those who have won Nobel Prizes and reinvented various fields in the humanities and the social sciences, I don't know if any had photographic memories. In fact, it's possible that having such a memory would be a hindrance, would stand in the way of charting new directions and creating new paradigms, which is the true stuff of genius, because you're considering you have everything in your mind, you know, it's hard to have a free mind, in order to create new ideas, paradigms, you sort of have to have a free mind to chart new directions, but if you don't know everything, and it's a mistake, some people say that Rav Avadya has a great memory, I can tell you right now he has no memory, and you might say, well, I'm crazy, there's no memory, this is said about the Rogachev originally, because memory is when you think about something, and you try to recall it, everything in his mind at one time, he sees it all at once. So he literally has no memory. It's all there. But from an academic perspective, as well as from the outlook of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, Rav Avadya's knowledge amounts to a collection of facts, an encyclopedia. But it doesn't have the real scholarly significance that those types are looking for. At best, they would acknowledge that he's a great technician, which he is. He's able to collect sources and balance one off another. But there's no advanced thinking or grand theories that make a contribution to knowledge, at least knowledge of the sort, that's valued in the academic world or that's valued in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, where they give shiurim, where it's all about analysis, idea, and intellectual probing, as opposed to gathering sources. Even in his responsa, Rav Avadya's responsa, which overwhelm you with their breadth, one can find on almost every page, Rav Avadya will cite a view, say, eno mukhrach, or eno mechuvar, that is, it's not, something's wrong with this view. And then he will cite a group of achronim, like 10 or 20 other authorities who disagree with this view, yet he hardly ever explains why the rejected opinion is wrong, how this author has misunderstood the Talmud or the Rambam. He simply quotes the author and said it's a problematic, and then he quotes 10 other views that disagree. Well, at the end of the day, certainly from the Lithuanian perspective, there's something deeply unsatisfying about declaring an opinion to be rejected simply because it is contradicted by 10 or even 20 other scholars. It's not hard to see why someone trained in the great Lithuanian yeshivas would not regard this as a proper approach to psak. In the Lithuanian Torah tradition, a posek is engaged in the search for truth. And if a posek feels that his interpretation is correct, the fact that there's 10 or 20 achronim who disagree with him is irrelevant. They have to show him why he has misunderstood the Rambam. The fact that 10 people disagree is irrelevant. Now, I see it's getting late, and I know we have time to have comments or questions, criticism, so let me just conclude by saying that I've really just touched the surface of Rav Avadya. In truth, we are not dealing here just with a man, but a phenomenon. We have been given the privilege, which comes about just perhaps a few times in a millennium, of before our very eyes being able to see the creation of a halachic tradition that has permanently altered the course of Torah Jewry. Thank you very much. Now, or should we take some questions? Yeah. I'll tell you how. First of all, has his writing translated to English? As far as I know, no. But you wouldn't find them interesting. It's over and over. It'd be very easy to translate, but it's just source after source after source. I don't know if anything's been translated. I think there's some translated in French, but I don't know if they've been translated. Yalpi Yosef is not by him. It's the summary of his writing. His son, Yitzhak, has been studying his father's writings for the last 30 years. He devotes every evening to it. And that's why if you look at Yitzhak Yosef, he's also an incredible Baki. Now, I've never had any personal dealings other than twice. When I was a counselor years ago, believe it or not, Camp Hillel and Deal, he came to the camp. He gave some interesting views there, sucking there to the student, just to shake his hand. And someone took a picture of me with him, but of course, forgot to put film in it, so I don't have a picture of me. But I can tell you that when I wrote this thing, of two of which are left, there was someone over at the seminary who kept insisting that Rav Avadya Yosef used to come late at night to visit Shaul Lieberman. And I knew it wasn't true, and I wanted to find out, he says it. So I had to ask Rav Avadya. So I called up, I spoke to his son, everything. He finally gave me the number of his personal secretary. His personal secretary took my fax in to Rav Avadya, and Rav Avadya told him flat out, it's not true, he knows who this person is, he never had any dealings. So I've never had any dealings. If you're asking how I know about his memory, because basically I read all his works, because I find them amazing. And I confess, I'm like everyone else, I use his writings. I do cite them, unlike many others, but I use them because they're encyclopedias, the like of which, you know, you can't get. So you can just see this, every issue under the sun. It's simply incredible. So anyone who reads his writings knows that this is someone who can talk about every single issue and knows every single source. And he does a lot of it by heart. I know someone who edited some of his tshuvot, one of my teachers. And you know how we know he does it by heart? Because he's misquoting. He'll quote the Rambam, and you look up the Rambam, you know, the words are off or something. He's quoting so much of this stuff by heart. I mean, I don't know the size of his brain. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And having said that, though, it's not the sort of knowledge that's either valued in the academic world or valued in the Lithuanian yeshiva world for good or bad. I'm not saying that's good or bad. That's could be debated. But it's a different type of knowledge. I mean, you have people who go, well, let's say appear on Jeopardy, who know enormous amounts too. That doesn't mean this is not, it's a different type of knowledge that could make it in the Torah world, but you couldn't be a philosopher with this type of knowledge. Yeah.
One more thing to add to this. When Gershom Salem wrote the book on Shabbatai Tzvi, the really big book,
yeah. He
writes in his introduction, he says the academic world really wouldn't care about rabbinical writings, and this is why hundreds of years later, now I'm going into it, he was a secular guy,
yeah.
And he pulled out history out of it. So one day, the academic world might be interested in what
No, no, they are interested. Right now, you have a doctor, a book is published, and a doctoral dissertation is going to be published. They're interested in the phenomenon. They're interested in method of psak. What I'm saying is that the form of not, so he's very significant. As I said, he's changed the course of Torah history. But in terms of the knowledge itself, in terms of, obviously, great respect for the amount of knowledge, but in terms of the accomplishment, in the academic world as a advances in knowledge in the sense of great minds. And if you go to the academic world, the Lithuanian yeshiva world, they wouldn't say Ravadia has a great mind. They'd say he's a brilliant. They wouldn't say he's brilliant. They say he has an incredible memory. Brilliant for them means people, Nobel Prize winners, creating new paradigms. And I understand, and that's really the reason, and I'm not saying this to criticize the Lithuanian yeshiva world. From their perspective, what makes someone great is analytical brilliance. Rav Avadya does not have that. Now, he thinks you don't need that. He thinks that's not what Torah is about. But Rav Avadya does not have the analytical brilliance. And if you spent your time in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, you find this far and fascinating, but that's not what learning is all about. You know, that's about getting idios, like reading the Talmudic Encyclopedia. But learning is about...
That exact point, speaks about that point. And it's really not... I don't think it's exactly fair to say that if he rejects an opinion and he brings you down 10 other later sources that reject that opinion, he just leaves it at that. He brings their reason why they're rejecting the opinion of those other sources. And
sometimes, yeah.
Sometimes. No, oftentimes. Yeah. And second is that he feels that through the course of the centuries, so many angles have been explored on each issue that if you just read what's available, you get almost all the possibilities there. That he has written that. Yeah. So I think that it's not exactly right that he doesn't care about academic analysis. It's that he thinks through reading what everybody has to say, usually when we speak about a subject, if you listen to all what the people have to say, usually you'll come up with most of the relevant opinions. And that's what he feels. But of course, the academic world will still say that's not, you know.
No, that's a very good point. Thank you. Of course, in the yeshiva, Lithuanian yeshiva, they say, Ein Beit Midrash B'lo Chidush. That's the whole point, that you do create new. I will say that some Sephardim pointed out, I saw this newspaper article last year, that there is a real problem with Rav Avadya's derech, and that lots of people today are trying to be Rav Avadya. You have young Sephardic Bachrim who are trying to replicate it with all this, trying to be kios. And Rav Avadya, actually, he's on top of all this, and he really understands it, and no one can replicate it. So it's a question, it remains to be seen whether that's another problem, that he's unique. Can anyone else really duplicate this, or are we going to get poor imitators? You know, he's, as I said, sui generis, unique.
Going back to Jewish history, which of those approaches have legitimacy?
What do you mean, which approaches? All approaches have
legitimacy. The Lithuanian approach and
Rav Avadya would point out that the Lithuanian approach is a new approach, pretty much the 19th century. So he says his approach. There's no question that the Rambam was not interested in this Lithuanian analysis. The Rambam was more interested in halakha l'maaseh. On the other hand, when you say they're all legitimate, all approaches are legitimate.
Historically accurate.
Historically, the Sephardic approach, I wouldn't say Rav Avadya's approach per se, because he is much more extreme in terms of the Great Bekiyut, but historically the Sephardic approach, going back... Rav Avadya, I would say, can't help it. He just knows so much that he has to throw this in. But basically, the approach taught in the Sephardic yeshivas is the more historical approach. It goes through the Rishonim, it goes through the Gaonim. I mean, that, if you want to know, for example, how the Rambam thought, you have to look at the Gaonim. So there's no question that the Sephardic approach is the more historical. But that's never been the determinant of what is regarded as valid or important. The whole notion, the idea that Torah is an ever-evolving, the whole notion of Chidush means we can come up with new ways of understanding and new approaches that help us understand Torah even better. That doesn't make it any less valid. The Tosafist method wasn't known before either. But, I mean, that helps us to better understand Torah. But you're right. Historically, the Sephardic approach, as taught in various Sephardic yeshivas, is the classic approach. But look what the Ashkenazic approach has produced. I mean, the great poskim and Torah authorities have soared heights of Torah scholarship. There's no question that they've reached these levels on their approach. Yeah.
You started off the lecture with Misty, which brought up the Katrina There's also a couple of other...
I didn't say misspeak. On the contrary, it's intention. He intentionally, that's his view, his theology. Mm-hmm. It's just that us in the Western world, we find it maybe outrageous, but it's not misspeak.
He made a couple of other outrageous remarks, like the one he said a couple of years ago that was on the local news about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And also one about don't take blood from a non-observant Jew because you might...
Don't walk between two women. Look, so, by the way, some of these statements, if you're in any yeshiva, you could hear the same things. This Rav Avadya is so important that they... some of them clearly reflect a different mentality. A very traditional mentality, in which, in others, there's a form of rhetoric. There's an article written by an interesting article that a lot of this is rhetoric. There's no question that some of it is rhetoric. because some of his comments, yet we know that on a personal level he doesn't have these views. So there is a notion of rhetoric being a darshan, you exaggerate. And some are just that he has very different views than he hasn't been exposed to the modern world. He's reflecting... It's hard for us to get a handle on this. There's no question that some of his statements are very troubling. But I mean, just because you're a gadol b'Torah doesn't mean that everything you say that everyone can't have questions on and find troubling. And I'd be the first one to say the Katrina thing I think was crazy. But on the other hand, that doesn't take away my respect for him or anything. He has a different theology. I don't go to Rav Avadia for theology. You know, I go to another Rav for theology. Yeah, I think we have to distinguish the two. You can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. He said certain things that come from a different... Remember, this is someone also whose whole life is in Torah. He's not polished in the manner of how to speak with non-religious. You know, he's speaking to his followers. He exaggerates. You know, they've always... Remember, his followers have said to him, you have to understand, Rav Avadia, you're on TV. They're taping you. So there's a combination of a lot of things here. Fundamentally, I think he comes from a different outlook than many people have, and... That's all. They're not as many crazy things as people think, but some are from our perspective. And he has been attacked by Haredim. I mean, by Sfardim, by Rabbonim have attacked him. And he's backtracked on some of them. He apologized for the Holocaust comment. He didn't mean to offend anyone. He was presenting a view about the Gilgul. He, Rav Avadia, has been able to, unlike many other Gedolim, and this is very important, on a number of occasions, Rav Avadia has apologized if he hurt someone, if he said this. Many Gedolim think that they're, and this is also the man who soars above everyone else. He very much is a man of the people. He has been willing to apologize. Let me give you an example. This incredible example. Do you know he had an engagement and he broke an engagement? And this bothered him all his life. And when he became chief rabbi, years later, he called this woman, who was already an old woman, to her to apologize. And she said to him, she was never able to have children. She said, it was obviously the will of Hashem, because I could never have children and you were destined to have children. But this is a man, Rav Avadia, who, you know, you think of great... This old woman from years and years ago, 50 years before, he calls her to apologize. It had been bothering him all those years. And you find in reading the books a number of examples of this. So you're really dealing with, even on a human level, despite if everyone had the camera on them 24 hours a day, you know, you'd see different. You're dealing with someone who really, on a personal level, is also quite incredible. Read what he wrote about Yitzhak Rabin after the assassination. I mean, you're dealing with an exceptional person. I mean this in all sincerity, an incredible individual in every respect. And I don't see it as any disrespect to analyze him as the books have, and he agreed. He cooperated with these books, and he also, unlike the Haredi Gedolim, thinks it's important to have real analysis of him and of what he's accomplished. He's cooperated with Rabbi Lau, who wrote a doctoral dissertation on him. You know, critical, he is fully open to critical analysis of him, even constructive criticism. He's very different than a typical Haredi. So it really is something refreshing, but it's probably because it comes from a different world. It doesn't come from the typical Haredi world, yeah.
You didn't mention anything about the influence of his son, Hamdanid. I know someone who knows, who's a Talmid Hakam in his own right, who knows Hakam Ovadia going back to Egypt and has followed his star rising, you know, over the decades. And he made a statement that if you plot a graph of, you know, on the y-axis, you know, from lenient to, you know, to Mahmir, and put it over time, you see that his 64 became more machmir as time went on, especially when after he sent Chaim David to Ashkenazi Yeshivot to study, and he took on a lot of their chumrot, and he had an influence on his father.
He sent his kids to Ashkenazi Yeshivas, those are the best Yeshivot. Chacham David is not the closest to his father. It's Rabbi Yitzhak. Chacham David is the Rav of in Har Nof. He's written also. He's thought to be greater than Rabbi Yitzhak. I will say I disagree with that. I know his Chivot very well, and I see no examples. He has become more. He's bought into the garb. He bought into some of the Ashkenazic practices. You know, appurtenances of the rabbinate. I don't see. He just came out with his Chivot. What was it? 10 years ago about gelatin. He just came out with. I mean, some of the Chivot I mentioned. I don't see how he's become, maybe you can correct me, and people here might know better than me, maybe some oral tshuva, I don't see how he's become more machmir over, now you might say, well, turning on lights on Yom Tov. But I don't think he ever permitted it. He always said, well, don't rebuke people, but if they do, but you shouldn't do it. I don't see it. I could be wrong, but they give the dates in his tshuva and Yabi Omer. I don't see, you still get shocking kulot and things that are shocking in this country. I don't see it. It could be wrong. I don't see that he's been influenced. He's been influenced by the Haredim politically in an Orthodox culture that, you know, creating an Orthodox community. Once the Sfaradim have become orthodox instead of observant, you have then sometimes the different, you know, you don't relate the same way to the non-religious, like in the old Sephardic culture. I think there's some of that. But I don't see the chumrot in halacha. Again, that's just what I've seen. I don't see any examples per se. And I don't see any extreme chumrot. You can almost guarantee he's going to try to find the kula if he can. So I don't know. Yeah.
Well,
he would, when I say analytical, I mean, if you look at an Ashkenazi work, they'll take the Rambam or the Talmud and they'll start analyzing it. Rav Avadya, he will be a great technician in a case like that. He will give all sorts of examples. You know, maybe he, I'm not even saying that he's not capable of doing it. You know, some in the Lithuanian world, they'll say he's not capable. Chamor no se sfarim, they'll say something like that. I'm not going to say that. He might be very well capable, but as Rabbi Shammah correctly pointed out, that's not what he regards as the proper approach. He will quote numerous parallel sources, different achronim, and then he'll come to a conclusion. He won't start from scratch, build a case from the Talmud and the Rishonim, and then come. He won't work with that way. That's not the way he works. So there's, so it's not analysis. It's more of like gathering all the sources together, seeing what more makes more sense to you, and leaning on one side as opposed to starting from scratch, trying to create. That's what Ashkenazi did. Try to create a building. Build a building. When you get to the top floor, you have your decision, and it flows through independent analysis rather than flowing through the use of sources. And I will say, I think there's some manipulation of the sources from Rav Avadya, because he's able to use this. He quotes, you know, so many sources that if he has a strong feeling that a position should be advocated, he's able to use certain sources and push in a certain way. Now, some might find that problematic. I don't. You know, the halakhic system is, works in different ways, but it's not analysis in the sense that we think of it in the academy. I believe, or the Lithuanian, certainly not in the Lithuanian yeshiva world. Yeah.
You mentioned that
you talking about the questions
for Rav Avadya being somewhat liberal in political views and security, and somewhat lenient on his Shavuot. And he's not a young man, and God forbid, when he's no longer with us, is this point of view going to be over, and then he'll be sort of dominated by the
look, you'll never have a successor take over him. His children will take over, and they'll. But it won't be the same thing. You'll have breakaways like you always do. I will tell you that the dovish political views are really not uncommon in the Haredi world. Rav Shach was always a dove also. The difference is, of course, that Rav Shach's, you know, his followers don't serve in the army or anything. Rav Avadya has tens of thousands of followers who are in the army, so it's a different... And he served as chief rabbi. I mean, he was very much involved in the state. So in terms of the political, you're always going to have people dovish. The Haredi world, especially, is always going to have doves. So Rav Yashiv came out publicly against the war in Lebanon last summer. In terms of leadership, you'll have other... It'll be like every century otherwise in Jewish history. You're a different rabbanim. Rav Avadya is unique in that he towers. And that's... So you'll have his children, you'll have others... When I say it's a permanent change, is because I don't believe, now you have the Sidurim, you have people who've changed their custom, you've had tens of thousands of Sephardim educated in the yeshivot, in the kolos, Dayanim from Rav Avadya's institution all over the country, they will carry on his psakim. So you're not going to get people now all of a sudden, let's go back to the old way of lighting Shabbat candles, with the Yalkut Yosef. I believe these are permanent changes of the sort that came about when the Shulchan Aruch was written and became accepted. You had permanent changes, unification. We now have a basically unified Sephardic land of Israel practice. And Rabbi Shammah, maybe you could elaborate a little more, has told me about how even in the Syrian community, you know, Torah comes out of Zion, that this community practices have been changed because of that, and I can't imagine them going back. Could you just briefly? I mean, it's correct, right?
Right, absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, there is presently a move in our community to allow weddings between Shavar Sabbat Tammuz and Rosh Chodesh Av. Even though we never did it yet in our community, to my knowledge, because Rabbi Jacob Kasson of Ashlom, who's been here since 1933, who passed away in 1994, he never allowed weddings in those weeks. But today, because the times require it, a lot of people want to get married, and a lot of other reasons, but there's a movement today to allow it, and a lot of rabbis are behind this movement. Last year, one of Achamar Vadya's students, Rabbi Aluf, performed the wedding between Shabbat Sabbat Tammuz and Rosh Chodesh Av. And he said, look, Achamar Vadya said it's allowed. And
how about with the hulavs?
Right, no, the women used to say a beracha, many women used to say beracha, even though before Achamar Vadya came along, there were many who told them not to, this we know from our youth, there was always a little controversy going on, but you'll hear some people who saying, oh, if they want to mekabel that minhag, they can. Shibub mitzvah, we used to hear that you could allow it. And there were many women. I remember our grandmothers, many of them who knew how to say Hebrew words, who knew how to, because in Syria they didn't all get an education, but those that did, many of them would say Beracha, and today, that was very much, but even in Tefillah, the Beit Yaakov movements in Israel, they're having a very hard time, that they had to implement the Chamor V'Diaz, that the Sephardic Beit Yaakovs for sure, but even those that were in Ashkenazic schools, not so many as you said, they had to change the practice of how the girls should daven every day.
Shabbat candles, he do it here? Like
Shabbat candles, we've all changed to Chamor V'Diaz Yosef's way. We've changed his way in many.
But when you were growing up, did they, how was it?
My mother would say the Beracha afterwards, and I changed her around.
So we see, okay, let's take two more questions, yeah, you.
I have two questions.
Yeah. Real world examples, yeah.
Does Ram Ovadiah talk about any writings about the Torah itself, or really it's all halakhot and sakim and all this,
He has drashot. He does, as far as I know, in his Haggadah, he has a commentary on Haggadah. He doesn't have a Peirush on Chumash, but he speaks about it all the time. This will come out. He has, for all the 100 books he's published, there's 1,000 books that's still in manuscript. He's written this all, but he believes Halakha is the most important. So they're putting the efforts now to publishing the Halakha. There will definitely be works published, his commentaries on Chumash. I will tell you, this came with a commentary on the Rambam, but it's also all very halakhic oriented. He has everything. He'll have, I don't think he'll have on the Mor Nevuchim, but everything else he'll have commentary on. He is as prolific as they come.
And one other quick question about, I remember on my honeymoon, I went to Israel.
Just one more question after this.
And he went to Kama Vajia's office and he gave us a bracha.
Yeah.
So you said before that he's not really into this Kabbalistic thing, which is all with, giving brachot, but I know he does give brachot.
No, I didn't say you're not giving brachot. I said the Kabbalistic thing that kameyas, amulets, they give an amulet, and then, you vote for my party, I give you an amulet, or I give you a blessing, or you come to me and I give you, say, certain sukim, and your child will be healed. He's not into that sort of thing. And he spoke very strongly when he was young against Rav Kaduri. He was able, when you're reaching out to the masses in a political party, he tolerated it. But the fact that he allowed these passages from his autobiography, from his diary to be put in a biography, he wants people to know that even though he tolerated it, this is not him. That Torah study is what's important. If you want Shamayim to listen to you, you learn Torah, you observe mitzvot, you don't play with amulets. That's what he was telling you by including these negative passages. Rav Kaduri, by the way, was one of his big opponents also. Because Rav Kaduri the Iraqi, Rav Avadi was kicked out of his shul. He could no longer give shiur in Rav Kaduri's shul because of the Ben Ishchai situation. Yeah, one more question.
I was not even a question, but a comment about changes. I don't think there's any Sephardic Siddur today that doesn't say Baruch Shah Sabi Kreksono instead of a whole bracha. Yeah. I grew up with the Dissolu Pool, the American Sephardic Siddur that was really accepted throughout this country, and that had a full bracha.
Yeah, let me explain for those who don't realize. The idea is that brachot, we're not supposed to say Hashem's name unless it goes back to the Talmud. So what about this bracha, Shasani Kirtzono, which is a medieval bracha? Well, they've already discussed it, the Rishonim. That's an example of where we break that rule. And that's been the custom, that was the custom among all Sfaradim. Rav Avadia, in his Sidur, it's strange, you look at it, it doesn't have it as a full bracha, just as bracha. But
Baruch Shasani
Kirtzono. If you looked at the Rav Mordechai Eliyahu's Sidur, it would have the full bracha, I'm sure, and all the others. But that has changed. That's another example of how he's changed. And numerous. I just gave you a couple here. We have one more. You can go down the list of examples of where Rav Avadia's influence has done the impossible. Change well-entrenched practices of many hundreds of years to create a new type of halachic observance. And that's, as I said, this comes about once or twice in a millennium.
Thank you.
So, thank you.